This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines: more Palestinians are killed as Israel keeps pounding Gaza on the 132nd day of its onslaught on the besieged strip. International pressure is mounting on Israel to refrain from a planned ground invasion of the southern Gaza city of Rafah. And the UN says U.S. decision to relist Yemen's Ansar Allah movement as a terrorist group could inflict serious harm on the country's devastated economy. Hello and welcome everybody. Here in the Iranian capital, Tehran, this is World News.
The Israeli regime keeps pounding the besieged Gaza Strip with airstrikes and artillery fire more than 130 days into the genocidal campaign. At least five Palestinians were killed after Israeli warplanes targeted residential buildings in Al-Zaytun area in Gaza City. In the north of Gaza City, two women and one child were killed by an Israeli airstrike on a civilian car. Earlier on Wednesday, eight Palestinians were killed and nearly two dozen others injured in Israeli attacks on the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital and the Nusayrat refugee camp in central Gaza. The health ministry in Gaza says 103 Palestinians have been killed in the past day, pushing the overall death toll to almost 28,600. Moti Abu Mosape joined us earlier from central Gaza City with more news on the latest ongoing Israeli bloodshed in the besieged Palestinian territory.
The Israeli killing machine still continues to target and to harvest more lives of the Palestinian innocent people and to inflict more destruction and devastation in all areas of Gaza Strip. In the central area of Gaza Strip, it was a horrific night for the Palestinian people as the Israeli warplanes carried out several fierce fire bells in the southern bars of Deir el-Balah city, where the eastern bars of the same city were under the heavy bombardments of the Israeli artillery. And as you can hear right now, the Israeli fighter drones are still flying at low levels. In the same context, we can say that the Israeli warplanes as well destroyed several residential buildings in Gaza City and even in Jabalia, refugee camp, leaving more Palestinian casualties. So we are talking about continuous Israeli airstrikes, and when it comes to the southern parts, we are talking about hyper and above and beyond catastrophic conditions for the Palestinian people.
Israeli genocide in the Gaza Strip has led to mass displacement of Palestinians. They've been forced to take shelter in tents or severely damaged structures without basic amenities. Let's take a listen to some of the Palestinians describing their dire conditions in the Jabalia refugee camp in northern Gaza.
There's no food, water, or medicine. I have lost a finger and I have no medicine. We haven't eaten bread for over 3 months as we lack flour.
Yeah, the children bring this flour from under the rubble so that we can sift it, as the livestock food that we used to eat is finished. They go to death and bring us this from the rubble of destroyed houses, and we sift it even though it is full of debris.
The situation here is bad. We have no food or water, and we don't even sleep well. We didn't have breakfast or lunch, and I'm trying to prepare food from cheese with malo. Even 1 kilo costs 6 to 7 shekel. We can't even afford to buy 1 kilo of cheese with malo.
We are displaced people and our children don't have food or clothes or blankets or electricity. Just nothing. A miserable life. We feel lifeless.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has vowed to go ahead with a planned ground assault on the southern Gaza city of Rafah despite international criticism and concern. Netanyahu reiterated his pledge despite warnings from many countries, including the regime's close allies. In a joint statement, Australia, Canada, and New Zealand have also expressed grave concern, saying a ground offensive in Rafah would be catastrophic. Several Western countries, including France, Germany, and Britain, have already warned that the Israeli military incursion would lead to a humanitarian disaster of a new magnitude. The International Committee of the Red Cross has also in a statement said that the aggression against Rafah would pose a, quote, disastrous risk to civilian lives and infrastructure. According to the UN, Rafah is currently hosting about half of the Gaza population. Well, for more on the situation in Gaza, we're now joined by a board member of Africa for Palestine, Farid Ishaq, who's joining us from Johannesburg. I'm also being told that we're joined by author and commentator John Stepling, who is joining us now from Inderoy. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Ishaq in Johannesburg, and please give us your perspective on this looming war crime, which the Israelis have promised and pledged to unleash a ground offensive in southern Gaza, in Rafah, where over half of the population has taken refuge there. What are we looking at for the consequences of this Israeli attack and this war crime that is pending?
Firstly, it's not so much a war crime that is pending, but an extension of a series of war crimes which constitutes genocide. And the impending attack on Gaza, or the commencement of attacks on Gaza, is not so much, as they're trying to say, the rooting out of Gaza. It is part of the decimation of the Palestinian people. And the tragedy is that the only reason why it is inviting the opprobrium or the calls for relief or a ceasefire from many of these Western powers, it is simply because the optics is becoming a bit too bad for them. It's not that they're really concerned about the Palestinian people, but for the Western media, the optics can no longer be reshaped. They can no longer be presented in such a way that the Palestinian, the death of Palestinians, the destruction of their homes and access to health, that all of these can simply no longer be avoided. And so they now have to deal with the problem of public opinion in their own countries. It's all of this, rather than a genuine concern for the ongoing decimation of the Palestinian people on the one hand, and the other hand, the weakness or the active collaboration of the neighboring Arab countries in the larger Zionist colonial settlers project.
Let's cross over to John Stepling in Inderoy, Norway. Mr. Stepling, let's backtrack to how this panned out up until the day that we are right now. The Israelis, they said, they issued warnings for Palestinians to evacuate to the south. They totally obliterated northern Gaza. Almost all of the population has been crammed into a small area in the south. And now they say that they want to launch an offensive in the south. This is the, it has all the ingredients of being a massacre, of being a genocidal onslaught, doesn't it?
Well, absolutely. But as your other guest said, this has been a genocide for a couple of months. It's been a massive series of war crimes, and this is just a continuation of that. The Western press remains pretty much silent about everything, but you can find the videos people make on social media, both the IDF soldiers making what they see as humorous videos of destroying Palestinian homes and abusing Palestinian prisoners. You can see the videos made by Palestinians and people trying to help, in which IDF soldiers are committing war crimes on a daily basis. There was one where they blindfolded a soldier and made him run and shot him as he was running away blindfolded. But these are everyday occurrences now. And not to mention the horror of what has been visited on the children of Gaza. I don't know how thousands of children have died now, and these are horrific images that people can't accept. Western leader continues blanket, unthinking, reflexive support for Israel, for the Zionist. Interesting, because there was a lot of uproar about Tucker Carlson's interview with Putin. The Western press couldn't wait to attack Putin and things he said, and he's a vile liar and so. And yet there was a conference at the Jerusalem Convention Center just last week, a conference for Israeli victory, something like that, in which various rabbis, politicians, including Netanyahu, Moshe Feigen, got up and said astoundingly both racist and comments that absolutely would constitute incitement to genocide. I mean, without question, said shocking things. Arabs are dirty criminals. They're like monkeys. They should be eliminated. Even the babies are terrorists. I mean, and yet there was not a single word in the Western press about that conference, about anything that was said by these extraordinarily bigoted, racist, white supremacist, Jewish supremacist, Zionist supremacist speakers, rabbis. It's breathtaking. I end up at a loss for words, because it speaks to just how completely compromised Western mainstream press has become.
All right, thanks a lot, gentlemen. We're short of time now. Author and commentator John Stepling joining us from Andorra, Norway, and board member for Palestine, Farid Issak, joining us from Johannesburg. Thank you. Over the past 4 months, relentless Israeli airstrikes and shelling have not only claimed innocent lives, but destroyed Gaza's vital infrastructures, including the electricity grid. Many Palestinians have come up with novel ideas to make up for power shortages. Some Gazans in the southern city of Rafah explain their experiments to cope with the crisis.
We have been staying at home for months because of the total blockade of Gaza and the outbreak of war. No jobs, thus no income, no public electricity, and the generators are running out of fuel. So many people here have invented other methods. Some even turned electricity supply into a business. They have to do that because the family needs income. There are also people who use handheld iron cranks to generate electricity or ride bicycles to drive generators.
For the first 20 days living in this tent, we had no electricity and therefore no lights. During the period, I had been thinking over the way to get electricity. So I went to the scrapyard and took home some fans. I assembled them, connected them to the wires, and put the batteries and lights on the ends. It can be seen as one of my own inventions. Fortunately, my experiment succeeded. At least now people don't need to live in the dark in the tent. I hope to expand the application of this invention so it could generate more electricity and hopefully light up the whole refugee camp.
We set up a charging station mainly for the people who live in tents because they have no place to get power. Dozens of devices can be charged at the same time here, most of which are mobile phones, batteries and radios, so that people can at least hear news and know what is going on. There has been a power outage for more than 100 days since the war began. We have been longing for power, but so far we have not seen it.
Hezbollah resistance movement has strongly condemned Israel's latest strikes on civilians in southern Lebanon, saying they will not go unanswered. The head of Lebanon's executive council, Hashem Safieddine, vowed the movement will undoubtedly respond to the regime's incursions at an appropriate level. He added that Israel will never achieve the goals that it failed to attain during previous acts of aggression against Lebanon. His comments came after, on Wednesday, Israeli warplanes struck several villages in southern Lebanon, killing 4 civilians, including a mother and her 2 children. A later strike on the city of Nabatea killed 4 civilians, from the same family, including two women. The regime claimed its attack was in response to an earlier Hezbollah strike that targeted several Israeli military sites, killing one soldier and injuring eight others. Hezbollah says its strikes on Israeli sites will only end when the regime's genocide in Gaza stops. The United Nations has voiced concern over a U.S. decision to relist Yemen's Ansarullah movement as a terrorist group. The world body says the measure could inflict serious harm on the war-torn country's devastated economy. Addressing a Security Council meeting, the UN Aid Operations Director Edem Wasornu said Washington's decision would have a huge impact on imports of essential goods that Yemenis now rely on more than ever. He stressed that humanitarian aid cannot make up for a shortage of goods and supplies that would ensue. U.S. decision, Wasornu said, transport costs to Hodeidah and aid imports have significantly increased due to the ongoing tensions in the Red Sea, and Yemen's economy cannot handle further shocks. The U.S. announced its decision in January, saying that it would take effect in 30 days, which falls on February 17th. It added that the designation could be reversed only if Yemen ceases attacks on Israeli-linked ships in the Red Sea in support of the Palestinian people in Gaza. Yemen has doubled down on its stance in supporting the innocent people of Palestine who are under Israel's genocidal attacks. The Yemeni Minister of Information has stressed that Yemen's naval operations in the Red Sea will continue unabated until the Gaza genocide ends. Abdulatif Al-Washali reports from Sana'a.
Press conference in the Yemeni capital Sana'a, Dayfullah Shami, spokesperson for the Yemeni government and Minister of Information, once the Yemen stands that the U.S. presence in the Red Sea is a real threat to international maritime navigation by militarizing international waters. As Shami stated that Washington's presence under the pretext of protecting Israeli vessels provokes the Yemeni army to continue its naval operations.
America is the source of real threats to navigation in the Red Sea and the Gulf of Aden, and the presence of its forces that came from a distance of 9,000 miles to launch an aggression against Yemen under false and blatant justifications. They are to protect the ships of the Israeli entity and support it economically and militarily, and have nothing to do with securing international navigation.
Hashemi added that the U.S. and U.K. have launched over 400 airstrikes against the Yemeni territories, resulting in the deaths of more than 40 soldiers. He asserted that neither Western aggression nor the U.S. designation of Ansarullah as a terrorist group will halt Yemen's naval operations in support of Palestinians.
The American designation of the Ansarullah movement as a terrorist group is ironic. How can a terrorist classify those who defend themselves and their causes as terrorists? This designation shows U.S. no longer has any steps to take to stop Yemeni operations in support of Palestine. This classification will not affect Yemen's military operations, but may be a provocation for greater escalation.
Earlier, the leader of the Ansarullah movement, Abdul Malik al-Houthi, stated that no Israeli-linked vessel has sailed through the Red Sea in the past weeks, describing this as a major victory. He accused the US and UK of being the real terrorists for assisting the Israeli regime in committing war crimes against the innocent people of the Gaza Strip.
Yemen's official stance is clear. The Yemeni army's naval operations will continue until the Israeli war against Gaza stops. Officials say the United States designation of the Ansarullah movement as a terrorist group will not help the US and UK achieve the objectives they failed to reach through military aggression.
British pressure group known as Republic says King Charles's cancer diagnosis will not stop anti-royalists from campaigning against the monarchical system in the country. The head of the group says the excessive media coverage of the king's cancer battle will rather buttress their arguments for the abolition of the monarchy. He said the news pushes a monarchy into the foreground and that fewer Britons like what they see. The group, which has been advocating the replacement of the monarchy with a parliamentary republic, says its revenue has grown extensively since passing of Queen Elizabeth. According to numerous polls, the popularity of British royals had oscillated over recent decades. Last month, YouGov polls showed an uptick in Republican sentiment in the UK. Young Brits are said to have become largely disengaged with the monarchy. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Hidden Files.
One 100 years ago, wars were fought with tanks, rifles, machine guns, chemical weapons, explosive devices, etc. Well, fast forward, and wars have gotten much more sophisticated. And at times, the most lethal weapon is intangible. From misinformation, media campaigns to sanctions, the tools of war have changed to target nations and to cause upheaval from within first, and then add the more common hardware tools to the chest, like WMDs, IEDs, phosphorus bombs and missiles, and, you know, great technological advancement like those. Just as there are alleged rules to traditional warfare that are not followed, so are there alleged rules to this new form of warfare, not targeting civilian populations and not inflicting collective punishment and not committing crimes against humanity. These are all nice concepts, which are not always followed. Hello and welcome to Hidden Files. I'm Marzia Hashimi, and today we will look at a form of war which many do not understand the effects of, sanctions, and especially the unilateral sanctions regime of the United States. According to the United Nations, sanctions are meant to be used as a last resort. It says it is a response to stopping extremism, curbing smuggling, and massive human rights violations. However, what has been the norm of the UN is that countries which are members of the Security Council are not sanctioned, and the sanction of others depends on the political and geostrategic interests of Security Council members. Well, the main sanction regime today comes from the United States and its unilateral sanctions. Washington sanctions a country and pressures other countries from dealing with the targeted sanctioned country, usually by economic threats or even worse. According to the United Nations, a proliferation of secondary sanctions has resulted in a growing fear of sanctions and overcompliance, leading to serious adverse effects on the human rights of millions of people around the world. Secondary sanctions are intended to prevent third parties, states, commercial entities, and individuals from trading with countries that are subject to sanctions issued by another country. We will talk about the legality of these unilateral sanctions a little bit later in the show.
Currently, a third of the world's population is affected by U.S. sanctions. Since 1990, the U.S. has imposed unilateral sanctions in over 20 countries. Countries that try to have independent policies from the United States are the most affected. Countries like Cuba, which has been on the U.S. sanctioned list for 61 years now. Iran, which was the most sanctioned country in history until the start of the Russia-Ukraine war. Iran has been on the U.S. sanctions list for 43 years. And now, Russia is the most sanctioned country in the world. Then there is Venezuela, which has suffered for years from U.S. sanctions due to its revolutionary policies. According to the Center for Economic and Policy Research, 40,000 Venezuelans have died due to U.S. sanctions.
I'd like to welcome our first guest to the show.
Cindy Sheehan. Cindy Sheehan is a peace and social justice advocate who became internationally prominent after her son Casey was killed in Iraq in 2004. She set up a peace camp near then-President George Bush's vacation home in Crawford, Texas. She is an author and hosts The Soapbox on Substack.
Well, thanks so much for being with us, Cindy. I'd like to hear your opinion on the way sanctions have been used to cause maximum pressure on countries and their populations.
Sanctions are supposedly put in place because the United States, the State Department, the politicians, the media, you know, whatever, this big class of propagandists, they'll say that so-and-so is killing his own people, so-and-so is a brutal dictatorship, blah, blah, blah. And so the United States, they're, you know, and Cuba is a perfect example of this. There's been a blockade in Cuba almost as long as I have been alive. And they're supposedly placed there so the people will get so disadvantaged and so upset with their own governments that they'll rise up against their governments. But as you know, a victim living in a place where there's been really harsh sanctions, that's not exactly what happens. And it actually is harmful to the people. And I believe, and I've talked to many people in the countries that you mentioned, and I've been to Cuba many times, it makes them stronger to stay firm against the empire, against imperialism, against neoliberalism.
Well, the irony of these U.S. sanctions is that the American people actually don't benefit from what their country is doing to others. So who's benefiting from this, Cindy?
The war profiteers, the globalists, the capitalists, they're the ones that profit. But we've seen here in the United States that even though it was a slow march to the collapse of our economic system here in the United States, especially since 2011, we've seen since the start of COVID, we've seen since the brutal sanctions put against Russia this year, that it is actually now starting to reflect here in the United States with gas prices and inflation, hyperinflation, the reduction of services, the crumbling of our infrastructure. So these sanctions are coming home to roost.
And any final comments that you have, Cindy, on this issue?
Many people are starting to wake up to that fact. And so while corporate media is collapsing, we're seeing the rise of alternative media and a rise of truth seekers. So there's still hope. And it's like talking person to person. I'm here in California at 8 o'clock in the morning. You're in Iran, 10 and a half hours away from me. And we know, just like exposing the truth from real humans, real workers, real people who are experiencing, you know, the good and the bad, and how we can work together for peace and for economic security and environmental sustainability for the entire world.
Oh, thank you so much, Cindy Sheehan, for being with us right here on Hidden Files.
One of the main messages broadcast about people, such as those living in Afghanistan, Venezuela, and Iran, is that they are suffering. We watch corporate media pump out story after story of the suffering of these people living in non-U.S. ally countries and tell how their pain, unlike that of people in Western countries, is the doing of violent criminals ruling their country without popular support. The part the media often entirely skips, however, is the role of the West in causing these issues. A role that can almost be summarized in a single word: sanctions. Sanctions are also known as unilateral coercive economic measures, which means that they are ways for, say, the U.S. to coerce governments of sovereign nations to give in to their demands. The U.S. has the power to do this because the petrodollar system, gives the U.S. dollar elevated status as the dominant currency in the global economy. And due to its dominance, it can also punish other governments if they continue to do business with the targets of these coercive measures. In this way, American officials aim to either make the government of the target country obey them or make its people so desperate that they'll overthrow their government in hopes of improving their situation. And the U.S. has used this form of economic warfare since the 1950s on a host of different nations like North Korea, Cuba, Iran, Syria, Venezuela, and others. Some of the toughest of all sanctions have been imposed on Iran, and politicians like Rudy Giuliani have openly said they are working because they make the people suffer. The biggest victims of this economic terrorism are people with rare diseases who cannot access essential medicines because of these sanctions and often die as a result.
Well, let me welcome our next guest to Hidden Files.
Alfred Maurice Dezayas. Dezayas is an expert for civil and political rights and has published 9 books on a variety of legal and historical issues. He has been visiting professor of law at numerous universities, including the University of British Columbia in Canada, the Graduate Institute of the University of Geneva, the DePaul University Law School in Chicago, the Human Rights Institute at the Irish National University, Galway, and the University of Trier, Germany. At present, he teaches international law at the Geneva School of Diplomacy.
Oh, welcome to the program, Mr. Dezayas. Let's start off with your perspective on unilateral coercive measures, otherwise known as sanctions.
What must be clear to every listener is that sanctions kill. I mean, sanctions kill just as much as a bullet. Sanctions kill when you siege a town, like the Nazis siege Leningrad. That cost between 700 and 1 million human lives. Now, the sanctions that the United States has imposed on Venezuela are estimated to have cost, in the year 2018 alone, 40,000 deaths. Now, when you add all the deaths attributable to unilateral coercive measures against Cuba, against Nicaragua, against Venezuela, against Syria, against Iran, you're going to go into the hundreds of thousands of deaths. And this is not an exaggeration. UNICEF carried out an investigation of sanctions against Iraq back in the 1990s, and the estimate is that 500,000 children died because of the sanctions.
Wow, unbelievable. I mean, you say that sanctions are killing people. Can there be international legal measures taken against these sanctions?
In the light of worldwide deaths, certainly of more than 100,000 human beings directly attributable to United Nations sanctions, this is a matter for Karim Khan, the chief prosecutor of the International Criminal Court. This clearly falls under Article 7 of the Statute of Rome, the Statute of the International Criminal Court. That is the article on crimes against humanity. This is what has to be argued in the General Assembly. This is what has to be argued in the Security Council. This is what has to be argued at DESA and all other United Nations agencies. We already have the excellent reports of Alena Dohan. She is the UN Special Rapporteur on the adverse impact of sanctions, not only U.S. sanctions, also sanctions imposed by the United Kingdom and by Canada and by France and Germany, et cetera, et cetera. They all kill. And that is so important that the mainstream media pick up on this piece of news. As I say, my American friends know nothing about this. They know nothing about the fact that sanctions kill. They assume that sanctions are there for good reasons to persuade governments to cease violating human rights. So the hypocrisy of it, the, shall we say, the cynicism of it is mind-boggling. But that is the situation we are living in. So my appeal, which I made in my book, Building a Just World Order, is that this issue be before the International Criminal Court. But in the meantime, it can also go up to the International Court of Justice, because the General Assembly, if you get enough votes in the General Assembly, so majority plus one, you can adopt the resolution elevating the question, the legal question of the illegality of unilateral coercive measures under the UN Charter, and elevate it to the International Court of Justice for an advisory opinion.
Well, what do you think the overall goal is for Washington and its sanctions regime?
Our government, there is what we term the deep state. And the deep state is made up of the military, industrial, digital, financial complex. Essentially, they call the shots. And they're making money. They're making plenty of money with war. They're certainly making a lot of money with the Ukraine war. And they're certainly making a lot of money with the sanctions. So the sanctions is a way, for instance, to prevent countries to do free trade and to buy cheaper where they can in the world. What sanctions have done, and people don't seem to realize it, sanctions have upturned, frustrated, subverted the benefits of globalization. Sanctions have essentially destroyed globalization and the supply chains and everything that goes with it. So that the United States, by weaponizing the dollar, is trying to impose on the rest of the world the U.S. imperial wishes. And as I said, I'm an American citizen, but I think like Noam Chomsky or like Jeffrey Sachs or like Dan Kovalik or Francis Boyle or Stephen Kinzer, who just abhor the weaponization of human rights actually to hurt people. And that exactly is what we're doing, but that with the complicity of the mainstream media, New York Times, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, CNN, Fox, and the others.
What can be done to counter these measures?
Until we realize that we are being lied to day in, day out, and that we are in the United States, in Canada, in the United Kingdom, in France, in Germany, in Switzerland, we won't be able to make any progress. So what can we do? Certainly give it publicity in the General Assembly, certainly give it publicity in the Security Council, appeal to UNICEF to carry out an investigation of the deaths attributable to sanctions, appeal to the WHO to carry out an investigation of deaths attributable to lack of access to medicine. Similarly, an appeal to the Food and Agriculture Organization, and then elevate the issue to the International Court of Justice. Is this a crime against humanity? Does this amount to a violation of Article 7 of the Statute of Rome? I have no hesitation to say that it does.
Well, do you think that these unilateral sanctions help to create an alliance between those countries which have been sanctioned?
The mindset in Washington is still the mindset of the unipolar world. And the United States just simply is striking right and left and imposing sanctions and intimidating countries and actually engaging in terror against governments, and has an enormous responsibility, both civil responsibility and criminal responsibility, for the consequences of those sanctions. But there again, that is what I say, and what Richard Falk says, and what Jeffrey Sachs says. But that is not what you're going to read in the New York Times and in the Washington Post. And thus far, I don't see the American media changing. I see the American media as the spokes, as the spokesperson, as the sounding board of the Pentagon and the sounding board of the State Department. So don't expect any level of self-criticism inside the established media. You can read very good analysis in the so-called alternative media.
Are there any final comments you have on this, Mr. DeZayas?
You will see that there's plenty of Americans who think like I do. On the other hand, none of us is in a position of power. None of us is in a position that we can actually influence policy. And we can write our articles and write our analysis and hope that some people who are in a position of power will say, that makes sense. Why not try that? Why not shift? Why not try a different paradigm than the unipolar paradigm that we now have?
Well, thank you so much for being with us right here on Hidden Files, Mr. Alfred DeZayas. As many countries continue to be affected by the sanctions regime, there's growing solidarity between many of the targeted countries and increased cooperation between them. These nations have had to be resilient and had to count on their own ingenuity to survive and, for many others, even thrive during these sanctions. And now it appears that the pendulum of global power is swinging, and it is heading towards the east. This should be a very interesting journey, and Hidden Files will keep you informed during this process. Well, it has been a pleasure being with you on this episode of Hidden Files, and hopefully you will join us next week. I'm Marzia Hashimi, signing out for myself and all the crew right here in Tehran. Goodbye for now.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us. And try to apply them to our daily lives. How is it possible? By means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من این قدم آخر نیست.
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step, brothers, not the last one.
هو الذي ارسل رسوله بالهدى ودين.
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth, that he may make it prevail over all religions, though the polytheists should be averse.
والذي ارسل رسوله بالهدى ودين الحق ليظهره على الدين كله ولو كره المشركون.
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش، با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد، موسیقی خاصی دارد، روش خاصی دارد، اینها چیزایی لازم است.
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones.
اما این کافی نیست.
But it's not enough.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا
دوری از قرآن.
Muslims' major problem is losing touch with the Quran. كتاب الله.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
The world is a very, very big house. Many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up. We must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters, and welcome to the program Keys of Life. This program is based on a very popular book, Mafatihul Hayat, by Ayatollah Javad Amili. And it's really, really an amazing book, which does give you the keys to life. In these episodes, we've been talking about how a believer should be with another believer. However, in this episode, we're going to sort of shift the topic, and we're going to go into how our relationship should be with disbelievers. Or before I actually get into that topic, right, we're really talking about how we behave with others, what our behavior with other people, other fellow human beings, the believers, you know, how we should be interacting with them. One of the things that the sixth Imam said, you know, to his fellow followers, he said, oh my Shia, oh my followers, you are connected to us, you know, you're connected to me. So be a beauty to us and don't become an embarrassment, you know, for us between people. He goes on to say, for example, be the helper of Imam Ali. And it's interesting to know, by the way, when he said this, he was really referring to how the Shia should be among other brothers of our other sects. For example, how they should be with our Sunni brothers and sisters. So here's where he was really giving advice. He said, you know, if other believers that may not belong to our sect, you know, you should go visit them when they're sick. You should go attend their burials. You should go and pray in their mosques, right? How amazing it is that our view towards other brothers and sisters of, you know, of other schools of thought is being explained in this way, that we should be living together with them, that we should be praying with them, that there should be brotherhood between us and friendship. And that will produce unity, that will produce harmony in society. Now coming to the next topic, you know, which is pretty much related, I would say, or interrelated, is, you know, our relationship with, then, once we move on from, you know, people from other sects, it's really, and our fellow believers, we then talk about, this book talks about how relationship should be with someone who's a fasiq. Now the word fasiq in Arabic comes from the word fasaqa. And what it really means is someone who breaks their agreement, right? Someone who doesn't stick to what they're saying, or if they made an agreement, they break it. It's more broadly used to describe disbelievers or sinners or people that break the law. And it's important for us to understand, you know, how we should be interacting with these people. And there again, there's divine psychological advice here, which you're not going to find, for example, in books written by, you know, some of the best doctors or the best psychologists in the world. So in the Quran, you know, there's many verses which refer to this group of people. One of those verses says, you know, if a fasiq, if a transgressor brings news to you, then, you know, go and research that news. Don't just blindly accept what they're having to say. Because if you do it, you know, it could be that that person is trying to cause you harm. That person who's breaking the laws, they're trying to manipulate you and how you view things. So it's important that when we find we're getting news from or, you know, information from disbelievers, that we research it. And I think this has become even more important today in the world that we're living in right now. And why do I say that? Because so much of our news is coming from, you know, our phones and the internet. And such a big part of the internet is controlled by transgressors, right? It's controlled by people that are disbelievers. And we know that their intentions many times, they openly actually state their intention that they are enemies, right? So it's important that all this information that we're getting, it's that we research it, that we don't just accept things as they're coming through. I'll talk a little bit more about this, but we have to go for a break.
آیت الله جوادی آملیدی, author of the book مفاتیح الحیات, The Keys of Life.
این مفاتیح باید دو جلد باشه, چندین سال این حرف گفته میشه.
This book مفاتیح ought to be in two volumes.
یه جلدش هی مفاتیح الجنان است, چه فرون دماغ و سواب داره فرون روزون است.
One volume, the present volume, مفاتیح الجنان, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc.
یه جلدش کم داره و اینه که فرون درختکاری اینجا کم سواب داره, دعا هم داره, سواب هم داره.
But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree.
امام اونطوری که اینو گفته برام گفته دی. اون امامی که گفته اگر روزه بگیری ثواب داره, همون امام گفته که اگر درخت بکاری ثواب داره.
Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam who has stressed out the reward for praying has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment. When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned. We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
I was discussing the verse from the Holy Quran, which talks about when a news comes from a disbeliever, you know, you should go and research it. Similarly, in other places, you know, we've been told in narrations is that you shouldn't accept the testimony, the evidence of someone who's a transgressor, someone who's breaking the laws. Other places we're told, I think general advice that's given is to stay away from such people, is to, you know, don't even go near these type of people many times who may have a very negative impact on you. But at the same time, you know, I think Islam is such a beautiful religion that in other places, in similar, you know, advice, there's a saying from the Prophet where he said that, you know, we should also tolerate, you know, people that may be disobeying God's commands, right? Not everyone is, you know, extremely evil. We don't have to go about fighting everyone. In fact, the Prophet went on to say that tolerating people is half of our faith, and softness towards them is half of our life. We have so many examples from the Prophet's life where, you know, idol worshippers or his enemies would do some really crazy things, but the Prophet would tolerate them. He would forgive them. His, you know, his manners towards those people was many times he would be soft towards them as well. So it could depend on the situation as well, you know, that we're in, that we have to learn to tolerate people who may not be obeying God. And, you know, we have to be soft towards them because that's a way to bring them towards our path. If we're always in this sort of aggressive mode, then we're going to turn people away from ourselves, right? They're not going to come towards this path. In relation to this, you know, the sixth Imam once said that regarding people who are sinners, on the surface, you can keep company with them, right? You may have to keep company with them and have involvement with them. For example, the society that we're living in, we have to keep company and we have to involve ourselves in the society. We can't cut ourselves off just because we're saying, you know, other people are, for example, sinners. But he says, don't become stuck with these people because they may end up oppressing you. So in your heart, you should know what's right. And when I say in your heart, this is something that Imam Ali said, that he said that someone who's a transgressor, who's a fasiq, for the sake of protecting your religion, you need to tolerate them and you need to have involvement with them. But he said in your heart, you should stay away from their behavior. It's really important for us to know, you know, inside ourselves, what are the correct values, what are the, you know, and how to deal with people. It is not an easy issue necessarily, right? It's a very challenging issue. And this is why this book, you know, is providing us with those keys of how we should be interacting with people. What happens when in a society, people that are sinners or that are breaking the laws, what happens if we start putting them in, let's say, leadership positions or we start honoring them? Imam Ali said in this regard that if a sinner is put in a leadership position and he or she is liked and honored, then you should just wait for a disaster, right? And of course, we see these disasters happening all around us, in our societies, in other countries. So this advice, you know, from Imam Ali is very much applicable for us today. So that's all the time we have for this episode. Inshallah, please join us again and learn more about the keys of life.
Driving past, walking fast, to the field of dreams, hear the children scream.
There was the Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind. A momentary emotion, space spent in time.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Of the soil from the blood and the ashes. It speaks with me the sound of the rain from the battle and the victory.
Never gone. I raise it with